listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Please remember to watch your language.
Look, I can't speak without swearing, and I've only got my grade 10, and I haven't had a cigarette since I've been arrested, and I'm ready to f***ing snap. So I'd like to make a request under the People's Freedom of Choices and Voices Act that I be able to smoke and swear in your courtroom. Because if I can't smoke and swear, I'm f***ed.
The following programming may contain content that some listeners find offensive. If you are sensitive to foul language or explicit content, please turn your radio the f*** off now.
It's the self-driving car crash edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, AI and what you need to know. Meteorite murderers, twins in space, and Fukushima 5 years later. Let's begin episode 331.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross-sort, politics, religion, economics, and, of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of sparks, though. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns. We've traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. Joining me again this week is Matt. Say hi, Matt.
Hi, Matt.
In light of the recent Google self-driving car accident, well, the first of which the AI was at fault, I thought we should take a look at the topic of artificial intelligence, or AI. Well, first we should kind of make a distinction between pseudo-synthetic and artificial intelligence. Pseudo-intelligence are programmed logic. One of the first examples were the Jacquard looms from over 200 years ago, which could weave patterns into cloth. These were holes punched into cards where, quote, the loom read them, and each hole coincided with a color thread, and line by line, a pattern was weaved. Many simple programs do basically the same thing. In fact, most electronics use linear, predictive, non-adaptive programming. Don't get to say that every day. This is the sort of one response to one question. Like the loom, it has no flexibility, it usually has a singular task, and it may look like it's thinking, but throw it the simplest curveball and it'll blow up. Synthetic intelligence, or weak or narrow intelligence, is more like part of a whole brain. These machines are thinking in the sense that they're taking in data from the world, applying an algorithm to think about the data, and then respond to said data based on its, and I shall put heavy quotes around this, based on its thoughts. The difference between pseudo-intelligence, because its intelligence is, basically it's 100% predictable. It doesn't really think, it just simply responds. Synthetic intelligence, although constrained, is not limited. Think about when you type something into a search engine and you see it trying to predict what it again thinks you're looking for. Another example would be Deep Blue, or Watson, who defeated the world's best human chess player and Jeopardy champion, respectively. These are very smart AIs, but in a narrow area. In Watson, it was great at Jeopardy, but it wouldn't know how to boil water or solve a math problem. Well, I guess unless it was in the form of an answer. Alex, what is 9? Watson, the cube of 3, the root of 729? Come on, Alex, you gotta give me more than that. Sorry, I couldn't resist. Artificial intelligence, usually it has three main features to be considered full AI, and that allows it to rise sort of above synthetic intelligence. First is its ability to be smart in general. That is to be good, not necessarily great, at playing chess, but also describing the contents of a room, writing a story, driving a car. This is often called artificial general intelligence. This is the smart like humans in that we can apply our intelligence to a wide variety of tasks, or we're smart in general. maybe Matt, you excuse.
Hey.
Unlike narrow AI, which is smart and only like one narrow function or task, another feature is the ability to be creative. That is to think non-linearly. I had stated that a difference between pseudo and synthetic intelligence is the former is completely predictable. Well, strictly speaking, that's not 100% true in that synthetic intelligence may not be completely predictable, but it has a limited flexibility of thought. It has a limited domain of freedom. What do I mean? Well, if I ask a pseudo-intelligence, what is a car, it would have one response. That would be hard-coded into its programming. Synthetic intelligence may have several responses, but they would all be automotive-related. That is, it would be bound by its concept or data set for the word car. You or me, and true AI, we could say blue, or a car is a taste on Sunday. I mean, it's nonsensical, but our intelligence gives us the freedom to associate words, acts, and concepts irrespective of their logical relationship. That's what we call creativity. For AI to truly break the bounds of being a simple machine, it needs to have the ability to be creative, to think thoughts that had never been thought before. This is how humans have conquered the world and created this intellectual rival in the first place. The last characteristic AI should have, and I would point out should as opposed to must have, is self-awareness. What does it mean to be self-aware? Well, most people think it means the ability, or perhaps perspective is a better word, the perspective of being able to see ourselves as agents in the world. That I have the ability to know that I'm I? A classic example of this idea is it's a test that they do on animals. Essentially, when an animal sees itself in the mirror, it doesn't know that that's itself. When they do this experiment, they'll put a dot on its forehead or something it can't see. Animals that are self-aware will realize that the image they're seeing isn't a rival or someone else, but it's themselves, and they'll go and they'll explore the dot on their forehead. It's actually quite remarkable. When you see these things, you'll get things like a gorilla will sit there and it'll start staring at its back, staring at parts of its body it's never seen before, and it has this sense of self-awareness that it knows who it is. Now, a little aside from this, we use this test because it's the way we know we're independent of the universe. But we know that because, well, we're us, and we only have the one data point. It's conceivable, or at least theoretical, that perhaps an entity could be self-aware, but fail our human bias test. So far what I've laid out there, Matt, do you have any thoughts about AI?
I have many thoughts, Donald. I have many thoughts. But to start us off with the bottom there of what you just said, we have a very limited, like you were saying, data perspective, right? We have one idea of what intelligence is and what it can be. However, and what you were saying about there could be an intelligence and it just fails our human testing of what that level should be, or a kind of Turing test in a certain way. And what if we find that intelligence elsewhere? How do we decide if that's intelligence or not? Now, so the issue for me is that I actually believe that sometime in, I would say, within a couple of my great-grandchildren, we will make first contact. And I'm thinking that we will have an expansion of what intelligence will mean. So I think this level of our understanding of what intelligence is limited. And I think that with your, you know, pseudo-intelligence or with our levels of what we're calling pseudo-intelligence and synthetic intelligence and these kinds of things, that they're very narrow, and I feel like they're also more blurred than what we know. So, for example, we have AlphaGo, right? So, which is the program that was designed by Google's DeepMind unit, which is now playing Go, right? This ancient game. With it's like, let's call it chess, like a type of chess. But either way, it's currently playing one of the champions, and it was winning, and now one of the champions, I forget what his name is, but he beat Google's AlphaGo. And I sat there and I thought to myself, what if they switch to another game? Now, would it be able to change over? What if it was programmed to change over? Does that still mean it's still AlphaGo?
No, that's fair. Because, I mean, it's not a simple question, right? There is a lot of things where you deal with the idea of the black box. So does it look like a human? Does it quack like a human? But I think that misses the point. That's one of the reasons why I stated out AI without making any reference to humans. I mean, like, there's no emotions, right? I mean, to be a proper human, you should have some emotions, and if you don't, we call that a sociopath. But there's no reason an intelligent entity needs to have emotions. So,
right, but the thing is, we do have a lot of people that don't, and I feel like a certain level of introvert can potentially not have any emotion whatsoever, but still not be a sociopath, right? So it's very difficult. And I did want to actually point out one thing during this. We were talking about the drive, Google's self-driving car. There was a man, there was a guy who was developing a self-driving car on his own. It was the person who first jailbroke an iPhone. I don't remember what his name was. But either way, what his technique of self-driving was to have the camera, to have the actual unit learn from the driver how to drive a car. So nothing would be pre-programmed, it would be learned. So let's say I would have this car, it would just observe my driving behaviors, and therefore it would find out that a stop sign is a stop sign, and, you know, green means go and don't hit people and all this kind of stuff. It would understand, you know, you're supposed to drive at 50 in this area, but you could probably go 60 and it would be okay. And this is one of the problems that Google's self-driving car is having right now, is it drives right to the laws, right to the rules of the road. So a yield sign or near construction, it's actually causing it's causing issues behind the car, accidents behind the car.
Interrupt just a little bit by explaining to the audience, in case they don't know, what happened to the Google car. So the Google car was driving along the road, and I think it was trying to merge onto a lane, and it was doing so slowly, but it thought that if it basically sort of jutted out in front of a oncoming vehicle, that vehicle would yield. And most times you would. Someone's trying to pull into your lane, you let them go. But in this particular instance, it was a city bus. And anyone who's driven in Vancouver know that city bus ain't taking second seat to nobody. So the car, the Google car is only going like 2 miles an hour. I could say it was going very slowly, but its assumption about the behavior of buses was technically correct, but culturally inappropriate, because bus drivers don't act like normal people. And that's where it got into this accident. And I think that's what you were going for, is the idea of sort of the neural net and self-learning algorithms that most people figure AI has to have in one form or another.
Yeah, it's and that's exactly the issue with its self-driving lifetime, right? And I was having a conversation with an engineer on what the best programming he believed would work for Google's driving car or any driving car, and it would be a mix between the two, but actually leaning more towards this cultural sense of how to drive. So yes, teach it that, you know, you're supposed to drive, these are the rules of the road, obviously don't hit people, obstacles, etc., but also allow it to observe what the general rules of cultural driving would be. So essentially teaching it to be more human.
Which is interesting because we really don't know what is human. I mean, we live the life, of course, but we really don't have a good understanding of what the human mind is or how it operates. And I think that's another... Well, I don't think... No, I was going to say, I think that's a challenge, but I think, no, it's not a challenge. I mean, we've been kind of meta on this, right? About, you know, how AI works and how it might work. But if we just go down to the basics and assume it's a black box. So it's a thinking machine and, you know, great, it does things. I think if we look at it on that level, your mixed learning styles is great. But where do we go sort of from here? So if I, again, conflate two sort of forms of, quote, artificial life, if I may conflate two forms of artificial life, if I may be so bold as to use that term, the AI being the brains and robotics being the brawn, we have Google Car, which is a robotic, artificially intelligent car. What is the sort of impact on that? I mean, we don't often think about it, but every day AI impacts every part of our life. If you do a Google search or you get suggestions from Netflix or iTunes, down to the fact that anti-locking brakes and airbags are a form of AI that intersects with our lives every day. And there's lots of promise with AI. We've been talking about, you know, self-driving cars that would basically make accidents a thing of the past. Workplaces where people don't work anymore. It's all computers and such. And, you know, there will be no injuries. Or if there is an injury, it is, quote unquote, a repair job on your robot. Curing things like cancer, the ability to know or predict when we will fail. I mean, one of the things that I thought was interesting about big data is a carpet that people have developed that measures your walk patterns and can predict, I believe, days in advance whether or not you're going to stumble. And again, it's not like, oops, I tripped over a dog. It's more like elderly people or that who have these, you know, mechanical reasons that they're going to fall. Anyhow, I digress. Matt, what are your thoughts about AI's promise for the future, or even AI in your everyday life?
It's massive. I've had visions, I've had dreams of a day when we are more integrated with AI, even more than we are now. Obviously, you're talking about, you know, Google searches and what I'm going to watch next on Netflix and, you know, my Spotify playlist. But especially for someone, let's take me, for instance, which I tend to do a lot. But, you know, I have three different types of medications that I have to take constantly, right? And I found I have allergies, and I found out 2 years ago or so that I'm not supposed to be taking any allergy medicine when I used to take it in the summer when I needed to. And so one of the things that AI is going to do is be a better doctor. Yes, you're talking about a cure for cancer, but what about on the daily level for anyone? You know, you input the fact that these are the symptoms that you're having, and we're not talking about WebMD here. But if you need to prescribe a medicine, and we need to know the effects that it's going to have on your current medicine, and you input data like your genetic code, an artificial doctor is going to be leaps and bounds better than, you know, a human doctor. Yes, there are times when you will need a human doctor still, obviously, because they'll be able to problem solve on the go. But for simple day-to-day GP practice, the use of an AI with a human doctor, it's amazing. And it's not just that. It's the fact that I think we as a species, in order to evolve, we ourselves on the personal level will need to integrate with robotics. So let's go with that.
It's funny that you mentioned it that way too, because often the role of robots and artificial intelligence in our lives is described as in waves, and how we've had sort of the first wave, which was the, you know, assembly plant kind of robot. And then you had sort of the second wave where you have sort of call centers that are actually roboticized, so that, you know, you're actually talking to a machine because it knows it can go through this sort of set. And the third wave has been, as you say, the replacement of professionals, people who said, oh, you're always going to need a doctor, you're always going to need a lawyer, where actually most studies that have been done found that doctors perform dramatically worse than artificial intelligence doing sort of the same thing. And for the obvious reason is my brain, I'm sitting there, okay, what are all the possible things that could be wrong with this person? And as good as I may be, a robot's capacity to go through all of the literature, all of the possible combinations is infinitely better than people are. Again, I would take this back to the idea of narrow AI, where, you know, as great as someone might be at chess or Go or Jeopardy, the raw computing power, the I don't have to worry about keeping my body warm or what am I going to do next week, but I can focus all my attention on this one particular task, just gives AI such a dramatic ability to leapfrog humans vis-a-vis this particular area. But what about the idea then of cybernetics? I mean, that's the next area. One of the big things recently has been the release of the new Samsung phone and the new VR gear that you get with it, virtual reality. Microsoft released recently the developer's edition of the HoloLens, which is augmented reality. The idea that the artificial intelligence and human intelligence will actually morph into one thing. Do you have any thoughts about that, Matt?
All right, let's stop. Have you seen the movie Her? I'm assuming your listeners have. Or some of them. But the movie Her is Joaquin Phoenix, who is amazing. Love him as an actor. But Her, the basis of the film, it's in the near future, or at least a future enough that we can recognize. And here, you're... it's like, I guess it would be a phone, but you're essentially... AI companion, kind of like Siri or OK Google, kind of runs your life, right? And eventually Joaquin Phoenix, this main character, sees a new AI that's just been released that has all of the features of a human being, right? So it's emotional, it's you know, it wants to be your friend, eventually wants to be your lover. But either way, he becomes attached to this one AI, right? So, actually in the film, a minor point as well is his apartment is also the spot of a video game. Like, he can turn on the video game and it would be a virtual reality, right? I think this film was amazing because it represents what I believe our future is going to be like. You have your virtual reality in your home for your movies. You have either an AI that is so realistic that you actually do companion with it, or like we are seeing now, obviously we text for our relationships, and you're going to see that more and more with, I would say, virtual reality FaceTime. That's how I'm going to put it. But this shift is going to happen. It already is. I used to play outside with my friends, and now it's Tuesday night, and we're sitting inside playing video games. Like, it's in different houses. So we're moving towards this virtual reality lifestyle at a faster pace than I think a lot of people would hope.
But then, of course, you have the dark side. So Eve is the good one. But what about Ex Machina, which basically is, it follows the story of a billionaire tech guy who creates basically like a Data, if you've ever watched Star Trek. So, you know.
But by the way, wait, we should stop. Are there going to be spoilers for our listeners here?
Yes. I think there will be spoilers. So if you haven't watched the movie, pause time. Watch the movie, and then restart time. Because as we know, time is an illusion. So, spoiler alerts. So, Ex Machina is basically about a billionaire tech guy who creates an artificial android intelligence. He then hires someone to test it to see if it passes the Turing test. And the basic Turing test is basically, if it seems like a human to the point where you can't tell the difference, it doesn't matter what's in the black box, you have consciousness. So, great, that's the great part of it. Until you find out that the iteration that's in the movie was actually number 143, and that the other ones were just sort of turned off or killed, or when the intelligence went wrong, it like causes these horrific, torturous, horrible things. And you suddenly realize, okay, we've made these things be alive. What do we owe them? I mean, if I get there and I have, and again, this is done in Star Trek, which is a wonderful, so much better than Star Wars, series where, you know, if these achieve intelligence and we start using them as robotic slaves, is that ethically okay? Can I torture an artificial intelligence if I was the kind of person to get off on that sort of thing? Matt?
It's going to be the next, you know, civil rights movement once we maybe someday get over the ones that are going through now, I guess. And will it be civil rights or will it be robotic rights? Right? So it's definitely something that's going to come up in the future. And that's why everyone says that we should worry about artificial intelligence, right? We should worry about robots taking over the world. But again, your optimistic person here, your optimistic point of view is that, you know, is it not going to be more of a discussion? Is it not going to be more of a, all right, let's come to a, you know, an agreement here? Again, another great film or another great series to look into, if you haven't noticed yet, I am a cinephile, but is Humans, I believe. It's a BBC television show, but it goes over artificial intelligence and how we use them as slaves, and eventually they become conscious, and how they deal with that is quite interesting. So
I think I would agree. I think we'll close out this little section by just, you know, you mentioned some of the threats, and I'm going to throw out four threats that have been raised, and what your thoughts might be, if any of these are real threats or not. One, which honestly I don't think we need AI to help us in at all, but the idea of the dumbing of humanity, that as we start offloading our intelligence, for lack of a better word, onto artificial machines, your phone, for example, that human intellect will actually degrade. Secondly, you have sort of the self-aware computer that suddenly realizes that humans are a potential threat, as in it could kill me by unplugging the computer or whatever. So in a sense of self-preservation, actively tries to destroy humanity, or in another scenario, is basically indifferent to humans, sees them maybe as pests because it is so much above it. And the last one, and this is the one I thought was most thought-provoking, and probably I'd say most probable if it was ever going to be this scenario, is by accidentally wiping out humanity. And the example that I've heard is you've tasked this artificial intelligence to cure cancer. So it very logically says, well, if there are no humans, there'll be no cancer. So it wipes out all the humans on the planet, thus fulfilling its task of curing cancer. Matt, do these things keep you up at night? Are your great-great-grandchildren going to have to be running from the Terminators of the future?
Don, nothing keeps me up at night. That is the magic of medicine. But there's a lot of things that give me pause. And artificial intelligence absolutely is one of those things, and how we're going to deal with that issue in the future. But I do believe that before Idiocracy hits, we will be smart enough to figure out a way to control the progression of artificial consciousness. I think there'll be a way for us to have a slow and positive transition into an artificial intelligent and human environment. I think that's something that we will see in the future. At least we can agree that Star Trek with Data would be a great thing. Data, it's still going to be a great thing to see in the future.
So Matt, I've been kind of controlling the whole direction of this conversation. Is there anything about AI that I've missed or that you think we should really at least touch upon, if not go into?
So we briefly went over Idiocracy, right? How intelligence will diminish. Sorry, yeah?
I don't think people know about the movie. that's both an insult and
Idiocracy not only is an Idiocracy, by the way, is not only an idea that we will eventually become a shadow of a society due to our idiocracy, so that only dumb people are breeding, and eventually that'll just keep getting worse and worse. Or not dumb people, I plan to breed, but essentially that the smartest of us will stop breeding and focus on studies. Their studies, I should say. Either way, there is a film with Luke Wilson, I believe, where he gets frozen in time and goes into the future, and he himself is not a very smart person, but when he goes into the future, he's the smartest one there is. So when I talk about Idiocracy, that's what I'm talking about. As we move on from our segment, from our fourth segment of what movies you should watch on this program. I mentioned that I am someone who believes in integration. So that the evolution of our species will eventually, it will necessitate our connection with technology. What I mean is either figuring out synthetic technologies that will integrate into our brains or whatever, or body parts. Anyway, they're currently researching, I forget where, and I was looking for the article, but how to actually download intelligence. So either using a chip or some other way, but I think that might be part of our future, is actually being able to download knowledge straight into our synapses. And I am someone who is completely on board with that. You know, the idea that we have to learn to be intelligent, I would disagree with. So I am all for the idea that we should start figuring out how to download. But I think that's something that will happen in the future, is downloading knowledge instead of learning.
Now, Justin, before any of my listeners call in and say, hey, are you making reference to the fighter pilot experiment that was mentioned, where they, in quotes here, they recorded the brain waves of a fighter pilot flying a jet, and then somehow uploaded that into a novice who never flown a plane before, and that the people who had this done versus people who didn't, they flew better and learned faster than the other ones. And if you'd heard that story, it's been completely debunked. Not that I disagree with you, Matt, that in the long run that we may be able to do that, but the study itself is actually one of the worst science reportings in a while. Let's continue on. I agree with you, Matt, that at some point, in the same way that either humanity is going to be dead or we're going to be an interstellar species, it's an inevitability. Although if Trump gets elected, that may be the end of life as we know it, and the idiocracy will take over. On that note, we're going to call this segment to an end, and we'll be back after this break.
When you purchase the latest TV, tablet, or smartphone, don't forget to do the right thing with your old ones. Recycle them. The Consumer Electronics Association and its members are making recycling your old devices as easy as buying new ones. Just go to greenergadgets.org, type in your zip code, and you'll instantly find the recycling location closest to your home. You'll also find recycling tips, like asking the store where you buy your new TV if they'll haul away your old one. Don't let your old tech tools clog your local landfill. Just visit greenergadgets.org.
Listen, if they're so hot, how come they're not tearing up the charts, babe?
Because you never play them, babe. At CITR, our hosts choose the music they play. That means our charts actually reflect the tastes of music lovers, as opposed to focus groups. So if you want to know what's really tearing up the charts, get your hands on a copy of Beatroot or Discorder magazine, or go online to CITR.ca. CITR's charts are based on actual spins motivated by actual preference. No payola, no marketing, just good tunes. Refreshing, no?
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on CITR 101.9 FM, your self-driving, AI-powered skeptical radio show. Now, we're running low on time, but there's a few things that happened this week that I think we should sort of bring up and talk about. So, just last week, Scott Kelly came back from outer space. Now, Scott Kelly is the longest American to ever have been in space, quote-unquote, a year-long experiment, but like most things American, he gets shortchanged a bit. He was only up there for 342 days. I mean, really, as if that was a long time. You might think I'm joking, but if you realize that the Soviets had people up there in space a lot longer, they actually had two people were longer, the longest being Valery Polyakov, who was up there for over 437 days in one stint. In fact, if you go for complete time in space, Scott only was up there for 520 days versus Polyakov, who was up there for almost 700 days. And you know what's the freakiest thing? He's still alive. He's like 73 years old. So, you know, who says you can't be an astronaut and live a long life? I mean, okay, nobody said that. But, you know, there's one of the implications. One of the implications of this is with Scott Kelly is doing a twin study. So while he was up there in space, his brother, Mark Kelly, was left behind. And they wanted to do a lot of studies as to, you know, what are the effects of space on people. And from the NASA website, to quote, research techniques used in personalized medicine, technologies such as genetic sequence, are employed to discern individual responses to spaceflight environment. And research into molecular level to whole body functions to brain functions is being integrated into this one coordinated study. So basically the idea is you have one guy up in space, one guy back on Earth. When you put them side by side, what are the differences? And this is like long time study until they both basically die off. Now, I was a little disappointed when I discovered that, well, Matt, when you do a study like this, you'd expect one to be the spaceman and the other not to be a spaceman, right? I mean, that would seem to be logical. But Mark Kelly,
unfortunately, his brother was also a spaceman.
Yes. He was up there for 54 days. So, yes, an order of magnitude difference. I'll give you that. And, you know, it's funny how coincidences, well, not coincidence, how there are weird links in life. Because Mark Kelly is actually the husband of Gabriel Gifford. And she was the congressperson who was shot in the head in Tucson in 2011. And those of us who are into politics and gun control, that was a huge thing. And to make it really shitty for poor old Mark is he was in space at the time. So NASA basically said, Mark, can we get you alone for a minute? And apparently, I mean, a space station, there's no such thing as alone. So when he got this news, I mean, oh my God, how horrific it would have been. But I digress. Matt, have you heard about this longest American in space and the twin studies?
Don, everything I bring up on the show ends up in space. So, absolutely. And I would like to point out one of the coolest things so far that they have learned is that he is a slight amount taller. So, apparently, that's one of the things that happens to you in space. You get slightly taller, which is kind of neat.
Yes, you do get taller. In fact, he's 2 inches taller or thereabouts. And part of that is because there's no gravity compressing his spinal column. So basically, it's just sort of relaxed and spread apart a bit. And that gave him the extra 2 inches. And that's quite cool.
So only a year in space, and you might be able to start dunking on Shaquille O'Neal.
Except, of course, the downside and part of what they're studying is you lose muscle mass, you lose bone mass. So I'm not sure he's going to be hitting the courts anytime soon. And because he's back in gravity,
he will shrink again. So that's that's a temporary.
So it's you come back for one game, you go back up for a year. Yeah. So it's brilliant. Like they're. And yes, of course, it would be great if the control was never in space. But they're trying to figure out what the effect of long-term travel is, right? So eventual missions to Mars to rescue Matt Damon. But, you know, how much radiation they're getting, you know, what will happen, again, with how tall you'll get and things like that. But other things like... what other conditions that can arise. So one thing they noticed very immediately is that when you're in space, you actually can lose your vision a little bit because the fluid that usually sinks to the bottom or your blood starts to go to your head and doesn't pool near the bottom anyway. But this is a great experiment. I'm really excited to see what is going to happen over the next little while. Even though Mr. Kelly has now retired from the space program, he will be checking in periodically to continue the study.
Yeah, and the timeliness, you know, again, it's one of those things. I'm quite sure in some secret lab, NASA's breeding triplets or quadruplets so it can do a proper controlled study. But barring that, I think it's this year or next year, they're launching to the International Space Station, an inflatable capsule, for lack of a better word, because this is one of the ideas is how can you build large structures in space when you're limited to basically the small rockets. And one of the ideas, well, why don't you just build the balloon, essentially, that's a tube. And Congress last year gave the NASA something like $50 million to build a prototype for a base module for long-term travel to Mars and that sort of thing, which using the new Orion rockets, which can hold much larger things. So how we do in space and how do we prevent things like radiation? There is lots of radiation in space, especially when you get out of the Van Allen belt and all that, where you're no longer protected from the sun's direct radiation. And this is just, I mean, this is just good science.
It's good science, but essentially it's just a really good point to bring up, and it's going to be something to follow in the future. And I think the best place to end this topic, just so we can wrap it in a neat little bun here, is one of the things they're talking about for shielding on the way to Mars is water and poop. And on that note...
Yes. Well, yes. And on that note,
we'll return after this break.
Hey, why so sad?
Oh, nothing, really.
Not very convincing, Jane girl. Whatever it is, I've got just the cure for it.
One, two, three,
four. Did you know CITR has a women's collective? This brand new collective is all about providing and fostering a community for women who are or who want to be in radio, fighting the gender disparity in media, and centering women's voices and issues. If you are a female-identified person or ally who's already involved in radio or wants somewhere to start, this collective is for you. Email womenscollective@citr.ca for more information and to get involved.
And tune in Friday at 6 p.m. for the collective show, Lady Radio, featuring music, interviews, events, news, commentary. Basically anything we care to talk about. See you then.
Well, how do you like it?
There's only one word for it. Terrific.
You know, I'm so proud of it, it's almost indecent of me.
Let's listen in as one poor soul tries to find something good to enjoy on the radio. Let's see here,
Oh. Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance.
Oh. Everybody. God, this is awful.
Well, I climbed up the mountain, climbed back down again for you. I climbed up the mountain again for you, and then I climbed back down, climbed
up. Isn't there anything? 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 Anything?
Listening to the radio these days can be distressing. Fortunately, here at CITR, our programmers choose the music that they play, so our charts reflect what people actually listen to. To find out what's really topping the charts, pick up a copy of Beatroot or Discorder magazine, or check us out online at CITR.ca. Unless, of course, you'd rather keep listening to the chart-topping single, Everybody Dance.
What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance. Everybody dance. Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance? Everybody.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on CITR 101.9 FM, your rational dose of information. And we're back.
So let's go up to what also happened on Saturday, I think it was the 5th year anniversary of the Fukushima nuclear disaster. And even I would call it a disaster because, well, what the hell else do you call it, right? I mean, when nuclear power plants basically have meltdowns, that's a disaster by anyone's remarks. One of the things that's interesting, and I guess time has sort of proven out, when it first happened, and I guess I don't blame people for freaking out because you have one of the largest earthquakes that ever hit Japan, followed by one of the largest tsunamis that ever hit Japan that causes the largest nuclear meltdown in Japanese history. Well, okay, the world's history sans Chernobyl. Worrying about stuff is valid. But we're 5 years on right now, and you still hear it, but not nearly as much, about people freaking out about the radiation that was released and how everyone in the West Coast of North America is going to be dead in months because of this leak. But we've sort of seen that, no, you know, yes, relatively speaking to other incidents, a lot of radiation was released. But mixed up in the atmosphere, in the oceans, it works out that you get far more radiation by taking a plane trip from Vancouver to Sydney, which I think you've done, Matt, than has ever suffered from these things. The people who've been working there, one worker so far may have contracted leukemia from the plant, although the radiation that he received was something like 2 sieverts, and most of the healthcare practitioners that deal with this sort of medicine say, well, you can't really have a causal relationship until you have about 5 sieverts. So it's unlikely that his cancer was caused by the radiation, but it could have been, you know, it's like, did this cigarette kill me or not? You're smoking, you're increasing your chances. Most people have the idea that there's no safe level of radiation. One of the interesting things I'd also heard about was they're talking about, you know, yes, they're picking up radioactive cesium, I think it is, or is it iodine, I forget which, in tuna. But what they don't mention is that the amount of naturally occurring radioactive potassium, I think it's potassium, in the fish itself is much higher than they'd get.
So, and Matt, all the bananas.
All the bananas, yes. And there's a measure of radiation by bananas, although it was kind of meant tongue-in-cheek. But
banana to scale, if we will.
Yes. So, Matt, 5 years out, what are your thoughts about Fukushima?
Honestly, what really comes to mind is just emotion. Like, I mean, and I think that's one of the things that we just need to remember is that, you know, a lot of people lost their lives in the event, and it's something to remember or something to commemorate on occasion. You know, as disasters like this, it's good to remember and to learn from. And there's not much, you know, we can do as a layperson, but it's good just to recognize that this was an event and this is what we have gone through and what families have lost and things of that nature.
I find it interesting about one of the reactions to this. And again, on some levels, yes, I can understand this, but it's the tree before the forest, or what, I'm not sure what metaphor you'd use here, is, you know, shutting down of all the nuclear reactors in Japan. And then that sort of being followed over by shutting them down in Germany. And there, you know, this backlash against nuclear energy. And again, on one hand, I can understand that it's like NIMBYism. Sure, it's a great idea, but not around my area. But the replacement for all that nuclear power were coal-powered power plants. And those kill thousands of people every year. not just from air pollution, but from people actually dying in the plants from industrial accidents and that sort of thing. Again, I've done this on the show before, where they sort of tallied up the number of people who've actually died from nuclear accidents versus those that die from coal plants. And it's like, okay, there may be a couple thousand that can be attributed to nuclear power plants, and that's including things like Chernobyl and all that sort of thing. But you're dealing with millions when you look at the long-term effects of coal plants. And it's just, it's
astronomical ratio is what it is. And it's just the same idea of people who are afraid of flying and yet get in their car to go to work every day. Like, you have way more of a chance of dying driving from, you know, home to the supermarket than you do when you're flying from Vancouver to, by the way, it was a layover in Manila and then to Sydney, Donald. But, and by the way, it was an 18-hour layover. It was horrible. However, it's the whole idea of shutting down.
No offense to our Filipino listeners.
No. Manila was lovely. The people were lovely. It's just that airport was atrocious and I had nowhere to go. New traveler. Anyway, we're cutting down on our time here. Most importantly, it's just this the fear of let's say, you know, instant catastrophe. The idea that we should shut down something that is much cleaner and much safer in the long run, even though it could cause a singular massive disaster, for a, you know, safer on the facade technology, coal, quote unquote, is a technology, but for coal plants, it's ridiculous. And let's just remember here, people, that we need to make sure to trust in clean technology,
science.
No matter, trust in science, and it will lead us through. And yes, these big disasters can happen, but stay the course.
Well, you know, and there's the other great irony is because of all this sort of fear and roadblocks that are put up for nuclear energy, the current nuclear plants we have now, they are getting old and they are getting to the point where they should be replaced. And they would be replaced with much safer, much more efficient, much better technology if only people would let them do it. But they have this gut-wrenching fear and they don't do it. So on that happy note, one last little thing I think we can squeeze in here. Apparently, the first human in history has been killed by a meteorite. Okay, probably not. But apparently, a bus driver in Vellore, India, was apparently killed by an explosion created by a crashing meteorite. Meteorites themselves actually have some very distinctive characteristics, and this is why a lot of experts don't think it was really a meteorite. The most notably being that they're covered in a fine layer of, I guess, glass. As the meteor hits the Earth's atmosphere, its surface heats up and melts the thin outer layer. We use this sort of effect when we do things like aerobraking with the Mars lander or the space shuttle. Or just like in the movie 2010, the year we made contact, which was a great movie. You should see that too while we're dropping movies throughout the show today.
Left, right, and center.
Now, of course, there are other tests which are being done. And as I said, most experts think this is probably a piece of an airplane or some sort of space junk from a satellite, which in my books makes it a meteorite. I mean, it doesn't have to be a rock. If part of a space shuttle falls from the sky, that's a meteorite in my book. Another reason why they don't think this is sort of the same thing is that they had a similar incident about a couple of days earlier. So who knows? But while I was doing some research about this sort of non-event, I discovered it's kind of a myth, an urban myth, that no one has ever been killed by a meteorite. History is full of accounts of people being killed by meteorites left, right, and center. Now, of course, caveat. The one problem is that all of these apparent reports seem to be unlikely or not credible. If one thinks about it, the odds of being hit by a meteorite must be several orders of magnitude greater than that being hit by lightning. A side note onto that, again, you always have to be careful where research leads you. The risk of being killed by lightning in Canada is about 3 in a million. That is about 10 people a year are killed. According to the U.S. stats, your lifetime risk of being hit by lightning you would think would be astronomical, but it's only 1 in 12,000. In fact, outside of flooding, lightning is the deadliest type of weather, if Wikipedia is to be believed. Matt, I just dumped a whole bunch of stuff on there. What do you take from all that?
I mean, as horrible as it is, I'm crossing my fingers that this is actually something we can validate. Just the idea that space is finally killing people, you know, again, fairly morbid, and I feel very bad for the victim. But so, I mean, yes, as we said, astronomically, but estimates for the mass of material that falls on the Earth every year, so, you know, meteorites, space dust, and other things of that nature, I don't know what else it would be, but estimates are anywhere between 30 and 80,000 tons per year. So, and there's a lot of us spread across, you know, this massive Earth that we have, and let's say over the course of 100 years, I don't see why many people couldn't have been hit already. It's just confirmation.
Well, and that doesn't even count the fact that, you know, there is our own space debris that's circling the Earth, right? There are hundreds of millions of little bits of space junk from our satellites, from a space hammer going flying. Now, of course, the small bits would never make it through the atmosphere. They would be they'd be destroyed. But for things that are, you know, large enough to kind of hit us, there are, again, tens of thousands of them out there. And who knows?
Yeah, there are about 500,000 pieces of space debris.
Yes. And of those, I have about 30,000 are large enough to actually, if they ever wanted to go through the atmosphere, they could probably do it. Although, I like the other estimate that there is about 5,000 tons of debris in orbit. And of that, 2,000 in low Earth orbit, which means it could come down and hit me.
Yay.
Actually, just looking at the stat, there's actually 1,500 objects that are over 100 kilograms. So definitely can slam through the atmosphere and smack me. And if that's on that, that's a pittance of the over 5,000 tons of space debris. That's a lot of crap up there.
It's a lot of space poop. Let's just throw it down again.
Yeah, which of course leads into another interesting thing about the day we won't be able to put any satellites in space because, well, they'll just get shot down from all the junk. Humans have this great ability to discover a brand new pristine environment and, well, put poop everywhere to follow Matt's lead.
Completely soil it. One other great thing that maybe we'll cover sometime is how we're going to get rid of the space debris, but there's a lot of cool things, cool projects, one of which the European Space Agency is working on, but is essentially a big space dumpster that flies around and captures stuff. They're talking about shooting them out. But either way, classic us, we're off topic again. It'll be really cool if we do know that meteorites are space is just the other thing that's going to start trying to kill us.
You know, this may actually be one of those things that in like War of the Worlds turns out to be the things that save us. Some massive alien invasion fleet comes and gets wiped out by all the space junk we have protecting our planet. And on that note, I think we should wrap things up. Say goodbye, Matt.
Goodbye, Matt. And remember to stay open, stay healthy, stay healthy.
And this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first